Hello and welcome, my name is Luke Burridge and this is the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. It's the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. As I said, there's no set schedule in any way. I just, you know, when I finish a book, I do the review and put it up here on the podcast feed. If you want to know more, just check out the sfbrp.com and just check out the information page or the SFBRP wiki there, all the information they need. Sorry if the sound quality isn't so great to this evening or today or whenever you're listening to this. It's because this evening I'm out on the road. I'm doing shows, as you know, I'm a professional juggler, and I'm doing shows out on the road, and I'm here in my camper van. So, maybe you'll hear other cars driving past and things like that. So, here we are in Kiel. So, lately I've been reading and reviewing some really chunky books, really long books, and doing long podcasts about long books. And, of course, because they're long books, I do the podcast weeks apart or quite a distance apart. So, I thought this time I was going to read a bit shorter book. So, I decided to read The Forever War by Joe Haldeman from 1974, or 1975, I think it's 1974. Let me just quickly look in the front of the book. Yes, 1974, there we go. So, this book is considered pretty much a classic of 70s science fiction, or even 20th century science fiction. I'm not quite sure how much of a classic it's considered. And it's mentioned in lots of sort of like best science fiction books or most accessible science fiction books and all that kind of thing, but I'd never actually read the book before, so I thought I'd read it and review it here. There's no reason why I've not read it before. It's just not a book I got to, I guess. So let's set up the universe here. There's this thing in this near the Earth, sort of in at the edge of the solar system, let's say it that, not near the Earth, galaxy-wise near the Earth, but, you know, in interstellar space, and they're called collapsars. And the idea is that if you aim your spaceship at this collapsar, you sort of dive in and you pop out again at another collapsar in the same direction. It doesn't matter how far away it is, but, you know, if there's one quite close to you in that direction, you pop out there. And this is never really explained in the book how it works or anything, you know, just the physics that, you know, that was discovered with the collapsar. They had to rewrite Einsteinian physics to sort of work it all out. So it's not explained in the book, even though our star of the book, our main character, has an IQ over 150, and he's a physicist. He never really explains it in that much detail, but, you know, I'll let it go, I guess. So, humans start exploring the galaxy via these collapsar wormhole gateway kind of things, and they lose contact with a few ships, and then they discover that the ships are being destroyed by an alien spacefaring race that they call the Taurans. For reasons which I'm not going to go into now. Anyway, there's Taurans there. And humans, they decide to fight back, take the fight back to the Taurans. So the book begins with the training and the outfitting of this elite group of soldiers, all with an IQ over 150 and all in peak physical fitness, and they're all conscripted against their will. They didn't decide to be there, they were all conscripted. And they're going to face the Taurans in the first ever ground assault of the war. At this point, they've been shooting, you know, at each other's ships, but they said, okay, there's this base on this planet, you're going to go through this wormhole, go through this collapsar, and take over this base. And that's pretty much where you set out with the training of this force. Like I said before, our hero, also an IQ over 150. His name is William Mandela, and this book is pretty much his story. It's told in the first person, and yeah, you pretty much follow this soldier's experience in the Forever War. So he's not actually anyone special in the group itself. He just goes along with it and happens to survive the first encounter, and then he goes back in, you know, another encounter, and he survives that as well. So that's why he's the story follows him in particular. And the story actually relies on a few things. First of all, number one, time dilation. Even though you've got these wormhole collapsar things, the spaceships have to speed up. They have to accelerate like to near light speed just to get to the collapsars and back again. So this means that, like, when you know, he goes out for like 6 months or a year. But because of time dilation, when William and his crew get back home to Earth for the first time, for them, only years passed. But back on Earth, 25 years have passed, or it's 25, 26, 27 years have passed back on Earth. So this results in future shock. So when they come back to Earth, everything's changed for the returning soldiers. The next thing that the book relies on is this complete and utter disregard for the human rights of the soldiers. They've been conscripted, not enlisted, so they didn't even want to be there in the first place. And yet the commanders, who are sort of trying to get them to fight and things, they just disregard any sort of like safety requirements. So even in the training, the lives of the soldiers are completely expendable. They literally say, okay, in this training exercise, by the end of it, probably around about 14 of you are going to be dead. And you think that, oh, that's great. And of course, in the front line, it's just expected that they're going to go in and maybe only about 40% of the people who start fighting are going to be still alive by the end of it. So yeah, there's pretty much no chance of surviving to the end of their active service, which is, again, is explored quite a bit in detail in this book. So the story has quite a cyclical feel to it in a way, because William, he goes out, he fights a battle, manages to survive somehow, and then returns to human-controlled space, maybe sometimes Earth, sometimes elsewhere, and then is in some way, he's like tricked or coerced or just told or ordered to, or sometimes he just decides to go on another mission himself. And this way, he keeps going on it, and each time Earth has changed more and more in more drastic ways, and each time he's gone for longer and longer period of time, he's going further, time dilation causing more time to pass. And so in the end, the war lasts for around about 1,000 years, and William managed to get all the way through. And but for him, 3 years have gone past, for Earth, 1,000 years. So that's pretty much the main reason why it's called the Forever War in the first place. So that's pretty much the story, or, again, as much of the story as I want to tell you here. The characters, the book, as I said, is written in a first-person narrative, so you get to know William quite well. The thing is, he's not actually a big hero. He just keeps surviving. That's the only thing that makes him special. When he's promoted at one point, he spends most of his time being really unsure of himself, and he's not very confident at all either. And I really like this in the book, because mostly heroes are way too clever, and he's got an IQ of 150, in physics or in sort of like scientist kind of stuff ways, but when he actually goes up in the real world, he's a real disadvantage compared to other people, and I actually really like that. Also, the at the beginning of the book, on the first page, you open it up, it's got the about an author bit, and it says that it's based on sort of personal experiences. So you can see that, like I say, that the book, the character of William Mandela, the main character, is probably based on Joe Haldeman's to a certain extent. And I think there's no coincidence that you notice Haldeman and Mandela are quite close, almost an anagram of each other, like Joe Haldeman-dela kind of thing. Yeah, it fits. Anyway, and then there's the other main character, I guess, is his love interest, which her name is Mary Gay Potter. I think it's Mary Gay. Or Marjorie. No, Mary Gay. It's a weird name anyway. And the thing is, apart from her distinctive name, Mary Gay Potter, she's almost completely forgettable. I can't really remember anything about her except her name, and that she's female, and that she was the love interest. She survives pretty much, you know, long enough to end up in bed with William for long periods of time. And also, she seems to be, for me, just a function of causing, like, emotional stress at the right point for William, or emotional goodness and happiness at the right point in the book, in the storyline for William, which is a bit of a pity. I'd really want more than that out of the main second character. The other characters in the book, I think mainly due to the nature of the story, because it's set over such a long period of time, and William Mandela is sort of like our everyman who takes us through this. They sort of fade in and out again. And I finished the book yesterday morning, and I can't really remember any of the names. I think there was one guy called Scott or Strott or something like that, who was a commander. And there were some other characters who I can sort of remember what they did and what the characters were said to be like. But actually, in the book itself, I can't really remember too much about who did what or what part they had in the story. But again, the book is only like 250 pages long, probably under that. Let me quickly look. 236 pages. Again, I should probably write this stuff down before, so I don't always have to keep looking at the book about this kind of stuff. So, so in that kind of time, I'd rather actually the author spend more time concentrating on the action and on the themes and talking about what's happening rather than about trying to, intricately develop some of the characters in the book. If you've got, like, a 700-page book, yeah, go for it. But in 250 pages, just get it over with. So, yeah, I guess that probably brings me on to the writing style. I made some notes about this because I thought it was very interesting. In such a small book, it's got a very plain writing style. if plain is the right word. I wasn't actually quite sure what word to describe his writing style is, because like in the first few chapters it's just like almost transcribed conversations or lectures or lessons between two characters. It's pretty much the commander standing up and saying, you will do this, then you'll do this, then you'll do this, then you'll do this, then you'll do this, and it's just like exposition without apology. So it's just like, okay, this is going to be what happens, and this is what happens, and it just tells you what happens. And it's really just written in the clearest and easiest way possible to get across the actions of what's happening. And the book that I just read previously to this was R. Scott Baker's Prince of Nothing book, the first one, The Darkness That Comes Before, and it's written in such a weird style that you've got to really think about it. And as compared to that, this is not dark. This is the light that comes after that book in my head, because it's just so easy to think about. You don't really need to think about anything except, okay, this happens, that happens. So there's battles and wars, and it's all described very well. And it never really dwells on the deaths of the soldiers. It just says things like, he jumped in the air and his head was blown off and he came down without a head. And then it just moves on with the action. There's very little sort of like emotional dwelling times. Although there are a few in the book, and when they do come, they do stand out quite well. But for the most part, it's just like, this happens, then it goes on to this, and then it does this, and our character's thinking that, you know, and I really quite like that. Also, there are lots of, you know, in a different level, there's lots of other, like, even though it's a very simple storytelling, there's lots of other things happening on different levels, which you got to think about. You won't notice them straight away. Oh, I did sometimes. Like, for one thing, I just wrote down a note here, Sawyer shit. Sawyer shit is the main swear word of choice for our 21st century soldiers. And I quite like that, because there's no reference to it at all except for this, and I'm just thinking, in the future, is everyone a vegetarian? Sawyer shit. Like, bullshit? Sawyer shit. What is it? You know, people don't eat cows anymore, and Sawyer is now the reference point when it comes to swearing. It's, you know, not bulls? I don't know. So there's those kind of things, and they're all the way through the book that you just suddenly, you're reading and you think, oh, is that? Maybe, like that. And I'm not quite sure, because it's not dwelled on at all. It's just written in exactly the same language, like the no-nonsense language that everyone else is. Also, in conversation, there's some real gems, like when talking about going up against the enemy in time dilation, one of the commanders says, the enemy are attacking us from the future. And I really like that kind of almost poetic language, because it just shows like a clear understanding of time dilation, how it affects the real world in that way. So, let's move on a bit. Yeah, the story itself and the book itself reminds me quite a bit of Heinlein. It actually says this on the back cover. It goes, this war is the opposite of the one Heinlein glorified in Starship Troopers. You know, a splendid, thoughtful adventure. And yeah, you can compare it and contrast it to Heinlein in many ways, which is pretty cool. For the start off, you know, Starship Troopers, yeah, that's all great. Interstellar war, fighting suits, exoskeleton kind of things, bugs and like aliens, and or aliens like bugs, sorry. But the book also reminded me, both in the structure sort of the story and the sort of the pacing of the story as well, to another Heinlein book, a juvenile called Have Spacesuit, Will Travel, which is pretty much one of my favourite or one of my most read Heinlein books. And in that, our hero goes from America and then up to the moon and then to Pluto and then to a nearby star and then the Magellanic Clouds and finally out to Andromeda Galaxy. And in the Forever War, our hero pretty much goes on the same kind of trip and the same kind of route, starting off in America, going out towards Pluto, going to near stars, going further and further afield, all the way out to the Magellanic Cloud as well. And also not just like exponentially longer steps in space, but also in the Forever War, longer and longer steps in time too. Although, again, I made a note of this because I thought it was quite interesting. In How Spacesuit Will Travel, the main hero goes off to the freezing planet of Pluto and has an adventure here. In the Forever War, they go to Charon, or Charon, or however you pronounce it. And these days we know Charon to be the twin planetoid of Pluto, or the sort of the moon of Pluto, or dwarf planet, or oh, I think they're called Plutoids now. I heard on the news a while ago, Plutoids is now the name for Pluto-like objects. Whatever they're calling them these days, that's where it is. But in this book, it refers to Charon as the planet twice the distance from the sun as Pluto. Sort of like, so it's this mysterious planet X way out in past the Oort cloud or whatever it is out there. So So I thought that was quite interesting because I don't think I've actually read a post Pluto not being a planet anymore in science fiction. Because you know when there was the latest space shuttle disaster, the Discovery space shuttle disaster. I think I've read a science fiction book that discusses that, even though it's just a few years ago. But I think Pluto, I guess, is too close for publication now. Other Heinlein things. Well, I guess like things unlike Heinlein, even though it reads very much in sort of the style of writing as a Heinlein book, there's no real fondness for free love and nudism and generally just getting on with each other that we know from Heinlein. There is plenty of sex mentioned, but instead of the sex being kind of loving sex between a close-knit group of people, the random sex is pretty much just used as a coping mechanism and nothing more and nothing less. It's like, okay, half of you are going to die tomorrow. What are you going to do now? Of course, you're going to screw your brains out with anyone who you want to and just get it on as you want to, which... I think it's quite cynical and pragmatic in a complete opposition from Heinlein's kind of sort of like free love, hippie kind of sexual adventures that he puts in his book. And also in a complete contrast to pretty much all of Heinlein's books, our hero isn't very much of a hero. He's not an anti-hero, but he's just sort of like someone who's not very heroic. In the entire book, and it's his story as well, but in the entire book there's pretty much two incidents where William Mandela comes up with a good idea that saves the day, and one of them is a really bad idea, or it's from his own stupidity anyway, and it didn't actually quite work out how he wanted to. Whereas in Heinlein books, the heroes are just so clever that that it hurts sometimes. So, like I say, even though it's very much like Heinlein, there's just so many differences, and I think that's what the real strength in this book lies, because it reads like a good adventure story, but it's so different from other sort of space adventures, and that's where it really shines. The themes really come out, and the messages that he's trying to get to. So I might as well just talk a little bit about the themes of the book. Again, very plainly written on one level, but again, it goes into so many different themes. Back to the beginning of the book, the first page, about the author. It's written about his experiences, personal experiences, as a combat veteran in the Vietnam War. And, of course, there is lots of parallels to draw there, which is quite cool. Of course, conscription-based army as well, not so cool. And also the whole kind of mindless war against an enemy that you don't really understand and you're really forced to see as inhuman just to go up against them. Because if you're not made to see them as inhuman, you wouldn't be fighting in the first place. So that's pretty cool. And also there's the whole kind of deer hunter, John Rambo side of things. Like, you get back from war and it's all you know for the last few years and it's changed you so much. And more importantly, your hometown has changed so much that you just can't fit in again. So what are you going to do? Maybe just re-enlist again back into the army? Because it's the only thing that you can do as aside from going mad, which is quite cool. Another idea... Actually, no, I won't get into that one. There's quite a lot of ideas. Okay, sex and sexuality. This is something I didn't really like so much in the book. Like, on Earth, back on Earth, you know, in the future, homosexuality is being promoted as a way to reduce the population of Earth. And in the much later in the book, heterosexuality is seen as a perversion, and everyone is homosexual, and this is something I just have a really hard time in buying, because I just don't see it. Like, in 25 years, or like, it literally takes 25-30 years from homosexuality to go from like being a very minority to a majority sexual orientation, and I just don't see that happening really, because, well, it just doesn't seem very scientific wave. But maybe it's like Pluto was once a moon and knowledge has moved on. I don't know. Back in 1974, 75, whenever this was written, sexual orientation could have been seen as something that you could change. So if it was promoted to you, maybe you could go, oh yeah, of course. Yeah, homosexuality, that'll do me. Whereas these days, I think knowledge has moved on and the majority scientific opinion seems to be that sexuality is pretty much something that you're born with, or... it's not something you like consciously choose. I don't know anyone who's gay who I've ever talked to and said that they weren't gay when they were children, or they remember a time when they became gay. I think that's the way I can put it. So the changes in this book in homosexuality, I just didn't get at all. So yeah, let's just wrap this up in things I like and things I don't like about the book. I like the battles. They're really cool. They're lots of bloody, and you can pretty much follow them. There are some points I thought, what's going on? But generally, it was all resolved well and believably. And more importantly, that when the battle began, nothing ever came in at the last minute to suddenly go, oh, look, and we're going to change everything now because they suddenly discovered this new bit of technology and they're going to sort it out that way. Nothing like that. It was, the rules were set out for each encounter, and they changed throughout the book, so it was very varied. But for each encounter, the rules are set out, and they're followed through to the end of the battle, and I really like that. Also, the writing style, I really like just the, this is it, then this happens. I really like that kind. And also the length of the book. And how much story and the exploration of the themes you can cram in to the story as well. Finally, the technology. I actually quite like quite a bit in this book. I'm not really going to go into it much because, again, I said I didn't want to talk too long in this episode. A lot of the technology that's involved is never actually explained very well. It just goes, here it is, and there it goes. But then again, nothing is really explained very well unless it has like a direct impact on the story. Like the politics back on Earth, never really explained very well at all, except like reaction to population troubles. It's just like, okay, they get back to Earth, and this is what it's like now, rather than this is what led up to that point. So that was quite an interesting way of like setting out the book, which I guess you've got to do if you want to put like 1,000 years of history into 250 pages. Things I didn't like a book. Well, I guess I can break this down. First of all, the relationship between William and Mary Gay, I just didn't really see the need for it. Or there was the need for it there, but I just didn't really see them falling in love or see them or what they saw in each other. And I guess this is often what happens in quite a few books that I read. A couple gets together and I just thought, why do those people find each other attractive? It's like, why did they go for each other over the other cool people in the book as well? Maybe in this book they're just the only people to survive for long enough to get into bed with each other for a long term, but maybe, I don't know. Like I say, it just seemed to be something. You know, they needed something like some tension in the book or some stake in the book. And so, of course, a love interest is something you can do, which I guess brings me to the next point of something that I didn't like about the book. And that is the lack of tension in the book, because it's written in the first person. I did this, then I did that. And of course, that means I am writing this book at some point in the future. So you know that I survived to get into the future. Which I guess you could say of any fiction, and you know the hero is going to survive to the end. Or you might do, or you're not sure, but like when you've got that, okay, this person definitely survives till the end of the story, I just, in a book about mindless war, when anyone can be killed here, and anyone can be killed there, and it's just random, or pretty much just random, knowing that the protagonist is just going to survive, it sort of killed the tension a bit for me, which I disliked. Sure, he gets beat up, and there's like, and it's his story, of course, and he is the one soldier who gets from the beginning of the war all the way through to the end of the war and survives. But then that brings me to point number three that I didn't like about the book, which is right at the end. I really don't want to spoil it, but you find out that he isn't the only survivor. He's not the only one who gets through the war, and there's like this happy ending worthy of Heinlein. Again, I don't want to spoil it too much by saying that. You can sort of see it coming, but there it is. And he goes through all the math in the book, which I thought was quite interesting. He says, okay, to survive until the end of the war, because you don't get out until you get through 10 years subjective of fighting. And it's like playing Russian roulette 10 times in a row with 4 bullets in 6 chambers in the gun, and you get all the way through. It's sort of like a 1.6 in a billion chance of getting through to the end or something like that. And then you get to the end and you find out, well, I don't want to spoil it too much. You find out something a bit disappointing after learning of all that math. Fourth point that I didn't like about the book is just like the ending of the book, the resolution of the war itself and how it's all cleared up. On some levels, like exploring themes of the book and the whole kind of point of the book and the exploration of warfare in the book, really, really good. On another level, like, is it a good story or not, and is it a satisfying ending, like, as a good sort of space adventure, space opera kind of sci-fi book? Not really that satisfying in that way. So I don't want to spoil it too much, but I'll just leave it there. So I'm going to rate the book. Again, not really sure about this because I'm split, you know, because it's like this clear mastery of like timeless storytelling. It's a winner in that regard. But at the same time, it isn't as timeless in many aspects as it could be. Like I say, the whole sort of like, what's the future going to be like? Can you persuade people to be homosexual? And I think it just goes into deeper detail into some of these themes, and things are put into the book as an exploration of some themes which didn't really have to be there. Like, because there's this whole kind of, like, gender kind of thing with the 50-50 split of soldiers being male and female. Good, great, but then most of, like, pretty much every single figure in authority who's taking, like, tactical decisions in the book are male. So it's like, you can do it one way, but not the other. So there's these things which, again, it just didn't sit right for me. If it was a longer book, yeah, you could have put all this stuff in there. But for a shorter book, I'd rather, like, have less messiness, less, like, ideas and themes and the story going different places in such a short book. But maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm just having future shock myself, because maybe he's just portraying a realistic future, but something that is so different that I just can't get my head around. So I'm not really sure. So a longer book will always pack in, like, a deeper exploration and more complex plots and more rounded characters, but The Forever War is pretty much up there with one of the best short fiction novels, science fiction novels that I've read, as the length of the book. Because, you know, bigger books, of course, you're going to get more enjoyment over time out of it, but for the time I've read it, it was a really, really good read, and these ratings are subjective, and I do think it's a book that you should definitely read, if possible, if you've not read it already. So I'm going to give it 4 stars. 4-star review. And, yeah, what have I got down here at the end of my notes? Next. Oh, yeah, another 4-star review, because I'm reading it and reviewing it and discussing it because it's a classic that I've not read yet, so you shouldn't be too surprised that I rate it highly. But there you go. So next book that I'm going to read, I actually started reading it last night. It's called Encounter with Tyber by Buzz Aldrin and John Barnes. And I'm just trying to find it. I had it right here a second ago. No, I can't find it now. But it is actually a book that I opened, because I opened this list of books at the end of last week's podcast, or Saturday's podcast, or whenever I put it out. And I said, okay, vote for the book that you want me to read next. And this book won. And there's two ways you can look at it. You could say it won by a massive margin, it got 100% of the vote. Or you could say, only one person sent me an email since Saturday and they said, read this book, so I've read it. And like I said, I've read it before, and it is actually one of the most memorable kind of large-scale science fiction books that I've read. Because I started reading it again last night, like I say, and even though I read it just like 8-9 years ago, I could remember like every next paragraph. I was thinking, oh, this happens next, and then I was reading it and going, yep, I remember that. This happens next, yep, I remember that. So I think I'm going to really enjoy reading this again, because, well, it's because I just remember it so much, so it must have been a good book if it's one of the most memorable books I've read before. So more on that next week, of course. Email me with your thoughts or your views or your recommendations of what book I should read next, or if I've annoyed you in any way. I get quite a bit of feedback about books that people want me to read, or other people's thoughts on the books that I'm reading. But if there's something you don't like about the podcast, if you think I'm going too long or going too short, just send me an email, luke@juggler.net. And if you're wondering about my voice, it's a bit more croaky than normal, because I've been doing lots of shows today here in Kiel, so I've been shouting a lot. Yesterday, I was doing this show at the Kiel Evoker. It's this big boat show, and this big rescue helicopter comes thundering over like this, and I don't have any amplification where I'm working, and so I'm having to shout over the noise of this helicopter doing a big helicopter display about 500 meters away in the middle of a harbour. So that's why my voice is a little bit croaky now. So anyway, thanks for listening. Thanks for sticking with it. Catch you later.